Okay, let's start. For those of you who haven't met Kathy Kunkel, Kathy, could you just stand up? Kathy, could you stand up so people can identify you? Kathy is the GSI for a while, and she and Tom are alternating. And her office hours begin next week, the 18th, Wednesday, from 10 to 12 noon at 399 Barrows Hall? Yeah, okay. Some of you, two of you, mistakenly thought her office hours were supposed to begin yesterday and unfortunately waited around for her, and they don't. They start next week. 2 weeks from today is the midterm. If you are still working with the old syllabus, you are not working with the correct syllabus. The new syllabus is posted on BeatSpace, and it states that there's a midterm in 2 weeks. The midterm will be closed book, closed notes, but you're allowed to bring a single double-sided piece of paper, 8.5 by 11, with anything on it you want. So you can put, you know, numbers that you would rather not have to remember. You can put equations. You can put anything you like on two sides of a single sheet of paper, and that'll be your crib sheet for the exam. My advice is don't try to put so much on it that you can't find anything or read it because it's too small. Yeah. Only if it's a number that I would have no reason for you to think that you should know it. But I'm not going to give you numbers, for example, for the global terrestrial net primary productivity. 50 gigatons of carbon per year. You should either remember it or have it on your crib sheet. That's a number that shows up a lot. And I'm not going to give you basic dimensions of the Earth type numbers. But if I give you a very specialized problem about a system we haven't talked about, like if I were to tell you to do a problem that involved Lake Superior and you needed to know the volume of Lake Superior, I would tell you. So, question of how specialized the issue is. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's some on BeatSpace. Do you recall, Kathy? There had been, and I think they're still there, some old midterms and finals. Yeah, we can put some on. The exam will be in this room, and bring blue books. Please don't put your answers on loose pieces of paper. It creates havoc when we try to grade. So everybody is responsible for going out and getting an exam book to put your answers on. At the end of the lecture, I will try to stop a few minutes before the hour so that you can go to the back of the room, don't do it now, and pick up both homework set one and homework set two, which have been graded. The grades are good. I'm pleased with how you all did. And there's one homework set from homework problem set one, which Kathy has that somebody didn't put their name on it. We have no idea whose it is. If you want credit and you don't see your homework back there and you know you handed it in, see Kathy. And she can, you can see whether the one she has is yours or not. And then tell her your name so she can make sure it gets entered on the grade spreadsheet. Yeah. It can be anything you like. You can write it with microfiche, but you can't bring a microfiche reader into the room. You're allowed to have a handheld calculator also. Any questions about the midterm or the change in schedule or anything? Yeah. It helps. I haven't written the exam yet, But you may end up, yeah, you may have to take the square root of some number. And it'll be a lot quicker if you do it with a calculator. I would advise you to have a calculator, although I'm not promising you'll need it. Other questions? No. Okay. I want to complete the phosphorus story and then talk about solving problems in physical chemistry, equilibrium relationships that are going to show up over and over again when we talk about the carbon cycle and also when we talk about acid deposition. Last time, I referred to a controversy that raged during the 1960s and 70s, had to do with the fact that lakes throughout the United States, particularly in the agricultural belt of the Midwest, also in Europe, were choking up with algae, blue-green algae particularly. It's a nitrogen-fixing species, and therefore phosphorus-limited because it can fix its nitrogen. So it doesn't have a nitrogen limit. It tends to be phosphorus limited. The lakes were choking up with these this species types of algae. It's not just one species. And becoming very unpleasant, prohibiting boating, canoeing, rowboating, motorboating, because the algae got too thick for the boats to penetrate, and leading to massive fish kills because of oxygen depletion when these blooms of algae finish their growth phase and start dying and decomposing. So arguments raged about whose fault it was. Everybody agreed it was a real problem and something had to be done, but what to do? And some scientists were seeing early on that it was very likely to be excess phosphorus coming off of farmers' fields because of the application of too much phosphate fertilizer, more than the plants needed for their growth, with the excess running off, entering streams and lakes. A secondary cause was attributed to the outflow from inadequately treated human wastes, from municipal waste, mainly from large cities, where the waste products overwhelm the treatment process. The approach that was taken was with the availability of large computers to build large models. And as I said last time, literally that hundreds of parameters characterize these models. Numerous species of plankton, many different chemical species, many parameters describing the flows of water, the mixing of water in the lakes, the currents, the temperature distribution within the lake, and so forth. And the models ended up proving whatever the modeler wanted them to prove. And they were sufficiently complicated that if you took various ranges of parameters, which were within bounds, because there are so many parameters, you couldn't actually measure them all and pin them down to precise values. So you'd estimate them, and if you wanted to show that phosphorus was the limiting nutrient and causing eutrophication, you would pick these parameters. If you wanted to do what the industry folks wanted to do, which was to show that either a buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was the problem, or land use causing more erosion of soil into lakes, which conveys nutrient into the lakes, you pick a different set of parameters. And big arguments raged between the Army Corps of Engineers, which tended to argue that it wasn't the fault of the farmers and the fertilizer makers and the sewage outflow, and university scientists who tended to think that it was indeed the fault of the fertilizers and sewage. The breakthrough, the first step in the breakthrough that actually solved the problem, resolved the controversy, and led to rather significant cleanup, was that work of the German limnologist Wohlenwieder, which I showed you in a graph last time, where you plot log of midsummer chlorophyll versus log of a phosphate loading rate quantity, F, a flow of phosphorus per unit area into a given lake, times the hydraulic residence time of the water in the lake. Hydraulic residence time means residence time if you ignore the evaporation pathway, just the stream outflow pathway. And if you take this times this unit per unit area loading rate, the input from streams that carry ag waste and so forth, or ag runoff, then what you got is a smear of data that fell on a nice line. And lines are nice because makes it easy to sort of see what might happen. If I took a lake that's up here and I lowered the inflow of phosphate so that this term goes to here, then if this is causal, I would expect to see a reduction in midsummer chlorophyll, in other words, an improvement. So this suggested, because of this clever way of drawing the graph and seeing the data all collapsing into a nice pattern, that maybe we could control this problem by lowering the inflow of phosphorus. So the graph suggested that the Army Corps was full of it and that the independent scientists who had been studying this had the right idea, namely phosphorus had a lot to do with this problem. Then along came two engineers who did the second step in this solution to the problem. And what they did is they took exactly the kind of model you would all now write down, having been through the first several weeks of ER 102. You would write a simple box model, right? Except it wouldn't be quite as simple as the one box model. What they did is they looked at the plumbing of the Great Lakes. And if you abstract in simplest form what the Great Lakes look like, it's five boxes because there are five lakes. Here's Superior. Here's Michigan, here's Huron, here's Erie, and here's Ontario. And there's inflow to Lake Superior from all the streams that drain into it. There's flow from Superior to Huron and Michigan to Huron. If you look at a map, you'll see this is the way it works. And all the way to Ontario and then out to St. Lawrence to the Atlantic from Ontario. So we have a box, a set of boxes, with inflows and outflows. And each lake has its... Let me draw these stream inflows with wiggly lines. This is the sum of all the streams that drain into each lake, and these are the interconnecting flows between the lakes. And for each lake, on average, if you did this over a decade, you would see that the lake level over a decade isn't changing much. So the sum of the inflows, boom, boom, and boom, must equal that outflow. And the inflow to Erie, which is this plus this, is going to equal the outflow from Erie. And the inflow to Ontario, which is this plus this, will equal the outflow. And you have to include evaporation. So we should put a little evaporation term from each lake as well. And this can be estimated. The evaporations are going to be proportional to lake area and somewhat temperature dependent. You can work that in. And you put in water conservation, and now you put a pollutant into each lake. And we know the loading rates from each lake because people went out and actually measured the phosphorus concentrations in the major streams that flow into each of the lakes. So the farms around in the drainage above Lake Superior are supplying phosphorus input. And there's phosphorus input into Huron. And each of these has some inflow of phosphorus. And then the phosphorus in this lake will start to flow into this lake. So by following the phosphorus arrows, and the inflows and outflows, you can write differential equations just like we did for a single lake where we got the MDT equals A minus BM. Now we're going to have a set of five equations, one for each lake's phosphorus concentration. And when you do that, you calculate something you also could have measured. But it's nice to be able to calculate it. What you measure or calculate with this box approach is the phosphorus concentrations in each lake. And you can compare that with the measured phosphorus concentrations. And they worked out pretty well. Not exact, because there are different levels of phosphorus uptake in each lake. And this isn't measuring, this model doesn't include the phosphorus uptake, so you put in a correction for that. When you're all done, you have an F term, the phosphate loading per unit area of each lake. Because you know how much for Huron, let's say, we know this flow and this flow and this flow based on the stock in here and the stock here. And so we can measure the inflow to Huron. We can locate that here. We can measure the hydraulic residence time of Huron. And we can locate ourselves for Lake Huron somewhere on this curve. And let's say we got this value. And then we can compare with the measured chlorophyll level. And indeed, it worked out that even though the limnologist who had first created this graph didn't put the Great Lakes on it, the Great Lakes fell on the graph. Now, why is this interesting? It's interesting because we can take F and we can reduce its value by treating the water that's flowing into these lakes. And since Superior and Michigan weren't that badly polluted to begin with, whereas these downstream lakes were worse, a lot of effort was made to start reducing phosphate input to Erie and Ontario especially. And it's amazing what happened. When you we passed rules that mandated different types of detergents in dishwater and laundry water so that we weren't using phosphate detergents but substitutes, that reduced hugely the amount of phosphorus coming out of municipal waste plants. That phosphate was the second biggest source of phosphorus into the streams and therefore into the lakes. Also, there was a big effort in the Midwest to reduce the amount of phosphorus that farmers were applying on farmlands, and the result was that the loading rates were reduced, and the model predicted what would happen to chlorophyll. And indeed, when they put in place in the 1970s these restrictions on phosphate use, the lakes got better and better, pretty much as predicted by this graph. What the point of this story is really that sometimes simple models, the kind of approach that you're being taught to use in this course, can make much more headway with a difficult problem than what are called sometimes more realistic models, namely more complicated models with more and more parameters. This was hard to argue with. It was so simple, you could solve the model with a handheld calculator. You didn't need to program it on a big computer. It looks complicated, but actually each term is just going to look like this. And you can put that all together in a simple way and draw conclusions and make predictions, and then when implementation of phosphate reduction is in place, you could test the predictions, and they work well. So the phosphate story is kind of a neat success story of how a combination of simple models and really insightful empirical analysis together can provide a lot of insight into complicated problems. The genius of this diagram was figuring out the right variables to use so that everything was simple. If you used the wrong variable here, you would have found that the graph was uninformative. And for example, if you had just used the concentration of phosphorus in the water, it would have been uninformative, because a lake can have a low concentration because it had a high loading rate. A lot of phosphorus was in the water, but then it all got taken up by the algae, created a dense bloom, and that lowered the phosphorus levels. So using phosphorus concentration as a variable here would have been misleading, but using the input inflow per unit area loading times the hydraulic residence time turned out to just do the trick just right. Just a few more things about phosphorus. It's really a fascinating element, and its role in ecosystems is interesting. I want to illustrate a concept of feedback by telling you one more thing about eutrophication. Phosphorus doesn't normally exist in just pure PO4-3 form. That's the ion of phosphorus. If you had pure water and you took phosphorus and put it in the water, it would ionize and you'd have PO4-3, a charge of minus, let me write that down, four oxygens and a -3 charge state. But usually what happens is phosphorus is bound up with other elements. And a very common form of phosphorus is FeO3PO4. And this is called ferric phosphate. So often phosphorus is bound up this way in lake waters, stream waters, ocean water. And this turns out to be a very insoluble compound. So it's low solubility. And as long as it's not soluble, liberating the phosphate ion, plants can't make use of it. Plants do not take this stuff up. By plants, I really mean more generally algae, phytoplankton, or macrophytic plants in a lake. What they want is this ion. But there is another form of iron phosphate called ferrous phosphate, F-E-R-R-O-U-S phosphate. And it's more soluble. And its chemical form is FeO2PO4. It's got one less oxygen. Okay. Now, what happens during an algal bloom? Let's say you've got a lake and a lot of phosphorus locked up in FeO3PO4. Not so soluble. But there's enough phosphorus to create some algae. And the algae grow. And through the early summer, the waters are warming, there's lots of light, you get a bloom of algae, but then they die off by mid or late summer. When they die, they decompose. When they decompose, oxygen is drawn out of the lake water because oxygen is consumed in decomposition. When oxygen is drawn out of lake water, there's a transition from ferric to the ferrous state. You can see this has one less oxygen, and the chemistry is complicated. I'm not going to go into it all here, but if you have a lake with insoluble, lumpy forms of ferric phosphate, and you reduce the oxygen levels, a chemical transition will occur from ferric to ferrous, and this becomes soluble, liberates the PO4, and you get a secondary bloom of algae. And this was happening. It was showing up in the eutrophied lakes. You get a spring bloom, you get a die-off, you get reduced oxygen levels, and then you get the rapid liberation of more phosphorus to create a secondary mid or late summer bloom. And so that was, interesting that it was finally realized that it was this chemistry involving ferric-ferrous transitions that was doing it. And what I want to do is just draw a little diagram that we often use to describe a situation like that. It's an example, the first example you'll see of many coming later in the course, of feedback diagram. What's a feedback diagram? Suppose I have a box which I label algae. So it's the living algae in the water. It's some measure of how much phytoplankton growth. Maybe it's concentration of chlorophyll. And I have another box, which I'll call oxygen, concentration of oxygen in the water. And then I'll have a third box, which I'll call dissolved phosphorus, available as PO4-3. Okay, if I were to increase this, I would increase the amount of algae in the lake. The more algae I have growing early in the summer, the more I'm going to have dying in midsummer. Algal cells only have a certain relatively short lifespan, a few weeks sometimes. And so more algae means, I guess we should put another box here. We'll call it decomposition. More algae means more decomposition. More decomposition affects oxygen. And then oxygen affects the amount of dissolved phosphorus. And let's put signs on these arrows. If I increase this, do I increase that? So let's put a plus sign. If I increase this, what do I do to that? I increase it. More algae means more stuff to decompose. If I increase decomposition, what do I do to this? Reduce it. So I'll put a minus sign. And if I increase this, what do I do to this? Decrease. If I decrease this, I increase that. Ferric to ferrous. If I increase this, I decrease that. In each case, I'm going to assign the sign in such a way as to answer the question, if I increase this box, what do I do to the next one? Connected to it by an arrow. So an increase here leads to... Did I get that wrong? I got that wrong, didn't I? It's a minus sign. If I increase the oxygen, I decrease the amount of dissolved phosphorus. Now, each sign is applied independently of what the other signs are. When you assign a sign, you're asking simply one question, ignoring everything else. Were I to increase this, would I increase that? If the answer is yes, you put a plus. If it's no, you put a minus. And then you do it independently for every pair of boxes connected by an arrow. And when you're all done, you have a feedback diagram. And if you multiply all the signs together, plus times minus, you get, in this case, what? Plus or minus. What do I get if I multiply plus times minus? Is that plus or minus? Plus. So this is overall a plus feedback diagram. That means it's called positive feedback. It amplifies. Algae promote more algae, eutrophication. So this is an example of one of two types of feedback diagrams that we'll keep encountering over and over again, especially as we get to the climate part of the course, where we either have a positive feedback loop or we might end up with a negative feedback loop. And positive feedback loops tend to amplify phenomena. Negative feedback loops tend to dampen phenomena. We'll see both types arising, and I want to, using this as a simple example to illustrate the concept. The important thing is sometimes you get fooled and you say, well, okay, if I increase decomposition, I'll get less oxygen, and now what would that do to the phosphorus? It would increase it, so I'll put a plus because it increases. But that's not the right way to think about it. Each sign should be assigned to an arrow, ignoring the whole rest of the diagram. So when you only look at this piece, you ask, will an increase in this cause an increase in that? If it is, you put a plus. If an increase in that causes a decrease in that, put a minus. And you do that independently for every pair of boxes connected by arrows, and then multiply the signs together, and you learn whether or not it's positive or negative feedback. why does the decrease in oxygen causes the transition from O3 to O2? And O2 is soluble, so it produces phosphorus. So a decrease in O increases soluble phosphorus. The mechanism is, I don't want to try to write down all the chemical reactions. I couldn't do it off the top of my head. It's not simple. But each of these substances is, it looks like just a single thing, but it's going through, there's a lot of chemistry involved in the here, which I'm not describing. We'll get to some of that later, but I'd rather just, at this point, leave it as just a phenomenon that you're going to have to take on faith. We'll talk about this kind of chemistry when we get into chemical reactions that govern things like weathering and, solid to liquid changes. It's got to do with solubility products, which are influenced by pH and oxygen levels. But I'd rather not take the time now to do the it would be another 10 minutes of stuff, and I'd rather not do it. It has nothing to do with realism. It's just a formal procedure for determining the overall sign of a feedback diagram. It's not a physical assumption or a chemical assumption that they're independent. They're not independent. I mean, what happens here will affect how much of this. But the influence of this on this is something that can be thought of as an independent issue. You can add, forgetting what how much algae there is and how much decomposition there is, if the only thing that's going to affect, if all of these are fixed, then only the change in this will either increase this or decrease it. And if you are consistent and ask the question, will an increase in that cause an increase in this or a decrease? And you do that consistently around the loop, then you've got the answer under any circumstance, independent or not. So it's a formal procedure, but we're not saying that each step is independent of the others. But the sign of the linkage is independent of the other steps. The causal relation between this and this is indeed independent of the rest of the system. That's clearly a legitimate assumption. Okay, so if you want some numbers on the stocks and flows of phosphorus on land and in the sea, go to the appendix of Cal. It's got information, numerical information about stocks and flows of phosphorus. And unless there's some questions about it, I want to turn to the next topic, which is chemical equilibria. And we'll start getting more and more insight into things like questions of mechanism. Any questions on phosphorus? What we're going to do now is cover a set of topics which you might have had in a PCHEM course if you've had physical chemistry. But what I've seen over the years is that even students who have taken PCHEM often don't really have a good grasp of the stuff I'm going to teach you. So you probably are going to be in better shape quickly understanding what I say if you've had a chemistry course. But even if you've had a chemistry course, stay tuned, because I think you'll learn some new things. We're interested in three types of situations. We have some container of water, and the container could be the ocean, or it could be a lake, or it could be a raindrop. Just a box of water. And there are, if it's pure water, H2O, it's fairly simple and nothing much to say. But what we're interested in is when there's something in the water, and there are three ways in which chemicals can enter into the water. We might have, for example, up in the atmosphere above the water, a gas like CO2. And the gas can diffuse into the water and start changing the chemistry of the water. It won't be just pure H2O anymore. It'll have CO2 in it. And the C and the O2 may combine with the H and make all kinds of interesting things. And in fact, it does. It forms materials like bicarbonate or carbonic acid or the carbonate ion, two minuses. So the chemistry gets interesting when certain gases dissolve into water. Some gases aren't interesting. If nitrous oxide dissolves in water, it's boring. It's just nitrous oxide in the water. But when CO2 gets into water, it gets interesting because new things form. So gases diffusing into water can create interesting chemistry. Another possibility is that we're going to take a test tube of some liquid like nitric acid, HNO3, or sulfuric acid, and dump it in the water. And we're going to get interesting chemistry when this interacts with this. It may not be a test tube of nitric acid. It might be raindrops with nitric acid because of coal burning producing acid rain. So we want to know what happens when a liquid containing interesting chemicals comes in contact with water. And then the third possibility is we have something dissolved here, like seashells, mineral solid object. It might be a seashell. It might be ferric phosphate. It might be whatever. It could be anything. It could be calcium sulfate or gypsum. And it's a solid, but the solid may dissolve into the water, and that can affect the chemistry of the water. So we have three ways to affect the chemistry of the water in the box. Gases diffusing in, liquids coming in like acid raindrops, or solids dissolving into the water and producing chemical changes in the water itself. And we want to be able to study those and reach conclusions about what we're going to call equilibrium concentrations. Now, the idea of an equilibrium concentration is straightforward. If I make a change, like I pour some nitric acid into a beaker of water or into a lake, on a relatively rapid time scale, something called equilibrium will set in. And an equilibrium is just like in our box model when we said the MDT will be zero if Fn equals Fout for that substance. Well, the in and the out reactions are now chemical reactions, and when they come into balance, we have equilibrium. And most chemical reactions involving either the effect of liquids into water or gases dissolving into water occur quickly, either anywhere from fractions of a second to minutes to hours, depending on the size, obviously, of the water body, but usually rather quickly, in the order of seconds or less. And slower are equilibria involving solids, because it takes time for solids to dissolve, and those can take anywhere from seconds or minutes to millennia or even millions of years, depending on the type solid. So we're going to deal with different time constants for reaching equilibrium, but the idea of equilibrium, nevertheless, is very important and straightforward. It is a statement that the reactions in each direction are in balance with each other. The flow rates are equal. So we have lots of different reactions that can occur. We might have chemical species A going to B plus C. Or we might have A plus B going to C plus D, or even more complicated. Very generally, those are things that could happen. For example, to take a very simple reaction, ordinary water with nothing else in it undergoes a reaction. And the reaction is that it partially ionizes, and it makes a H plus, a hydrogen ion, which is positively charged, and a hydroxyl minus charged ion. And not all the H2O will do this, but some of it will. And so even in pure water, there's some interesting chemistry. An example of A goes to B plus C. An example of A plus B goes to C plus D would be, we might have H2O plus ammonia, NH3, and that goes to NH4 plus OH minus. If you pour liquid ammonium from a jar from the supermarket into water, you'll get some ammonium ions and some hydroxyl ions. Those are just two of countless examples of not equilibrium reactions, but of chemical reactions that occur in water. And they can go both ways. I drew the arrow going to the right, but we could just as well have said H plus plus OH minus can go back and make H2O. So in any given collection of water, if you could look at it with a super duper microscope, you would see some H2O molecules dissociating into H plus and OH minus at any moment, and other places in the water you would see an H plus and an OH minus going the other way back to making undissociated H2O. And equilibrium means the forward and the backward reactions occur at the same rate. In general, you can show from this really comes out of the physics of thermodynamics. If you've had either a good PChem course or a thermodynamics course, you learned that there's a relatively simple expression for the equilibrium state of reactions like those. And here's how it looks. For A plus B goes to C, in general, I'm going to write this and then explain it. Like this, and in the case of A plus B goes to C plus D, it looks like this. Don't worry, I'm going to explain these silly looking symbols. Let's put a 1 and a 2 here. 1 and a 2. Okay. There are about three things I need to say about this to clarify what I'm doing. First of all, when I write the reaction as A plus B goes to C plus D, I didn't write C plus D goes to A plus B. I wrote A plus B goes to C plus D. That seems totally arbitrary because I haven't told you what A and B and C and D are. True. But if the reaction is written in a textbook or in the appendix to Cal or in a journal paper as A plus B goes to C plus D, you always put the stuff on the right in the numerator and the stuff on the left in the denominator. So the C and the D are on top, and for A goes to B plus C, the B and the C are on top, and the thing on the left or the things on the left go in the denominator. Just a convention, but you got to stick with that convention because you're going to get tabulated values of these constants called equilibrium constants, and you have to make sure you got the right one. If you put the A and B on the top and the C and D on the bottom, this would be the inverse. So to avoid confusion, textbooks and chemists always write the reaction in a certain order. A plus B goes to C plus D, even though it's really going both ways. And in equilibrium, the two rates are equal. You still write it one way. And when you write it with A and B on the left, then you got to put A and B in the denominator. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two, what are these silly symbols with the square brackets? That means moles per liter. You know what a mole is, and you know what a liter is. So all concentrations are, by convention, expressed in units of moles per liter. Not moles per gallon or moles per cubic centimeter, not grams per anything, but moles per liter. So you express concentrations in moles per liter. You put the stuff on the right in the numerator and the stuff on the left in the denominator. Now we have this funny thing on the right, and I've written it two ways with an identical sign, meaning this is just a different notation. First of all, this is not P times K. It's PK. It's a single thing. Don't think of it as a product of two different symbols. PK. Say it fast and you won't get confused. 10 to the minus PK is also defined as capital K. Just K alone. And these are called equilibrium constants. And sometimes you'll see chemical reactions tabulated in a handbook, like the Handbook of Physics and Chemistry, and the PKs given for each reaction. And other times you'll see the Ks given. Depends on the convention. But if it's PK, they'll say it's PK. And if it's K, they'll say it's K. And the K, the negative log to base 10 of K is PK. So a PK is the negative log base 10 of whatever K is, by definition, because 10 to the minus PK is K. And every reaction has its unique PK, or K. So these reactions I've written down have different PKs. Well, let's look at one. Let's look at water dissociating into H plus and OH minus. We have the OH minus times the H plus divided by the concentration of water equals some 10 to the minus something. And here I have to tell you a fourth thing that you need to know when you apply this equilibrium language to a real problem. It is a convention that is respected by every textbook, every journal paper, every tabulation of constants, that by convention, H2O, which is the concentration of water in water in units of moles per liter, is not what it really would be. If you actually calculate the concentration of water in water, it's 55 moles per liter. A liter weighs 1,000 grams. Water has a molecular weight of 18. So 1,000 divided by 18 is 55. And this should be, if we were consistent, it would be 55. But the K and the PK are tabulated as if this is 1. So respect the convention that the concentration of water and water symbol is ignorable. It's 1, so you don't have to even write it down. It makes life simpler. You don't have 55s floating around in all the calculations. And the K and the PK are given to you in numerical values that assume you remembered to set H2O equal to 1, not 55. In the back of Cal, in the appendix, you will see tons of values of PKs and Ks or Ks. I can't even remember which one I used there, maybe both, in order to give you numerical data so that you can solve problems. Anyway, let's work this out now. If you look in the back of Cal, you'll see that the PK for water dissociation is 14. And so what that means is that the product, since H2O is 1, OH minus times H plus is 10 to the minus 14. Now, with that information in hand, we can learn something interesting that you probably already knew about water, but it will illustrate a principle. If I start with a glass of pure water, it has no net electric charge. If a glass of water had a net charge, it would be pretty dramatic. Two glasses of water would either attract or repel, and you'd have lots of fun. But water's neutral. So if I start out with pure H2O and it dissociates, I know something about how much of these I can have. At least I know a relation between them. And the reason we know a relation is we were clever enough to use moles per liter, not grams per liter. And moles are enormously useful way to express concentrations, because any mole of a substance contains Avogadro's number of ions or molecules. So a mole of H plus contains Avogadro's number of positively charged units, ions, H pluses. And a mole of OH minus contains Avogadro's number. So when we work with moles, we're working with numbers of objects. And it's the objects that carry a charge of plus or minus, the objects being the H plus ion or the OH minus ion. And one minus charge is the same magnitude but opposite sign as a positive charge. And so charge neutrality, the statement that the glass of water had no net charge, can be rewritten as the statement that whatever this concentration of H plus is at the end of the dissociation reaction, when it's all equilibrated, it has to equal this. The plus charges have to equal in numbers of charges the negative charges. And since this is moles per liter, and moles corresponds to fixed number, Avogadro's number of objects, charge neutrality implies this. Okay, simultaneous equations, two unknowns, two equations, I can solve, and I get H plus squared equals 10 to the minus 14, or H plus equals 10 to the minus 7, and that's something you probably knew, because we can define something called the pH of rain, or not of rain, of water, pure water, and it's the negative log base 10 of the concentration of hydrogen ions. Just like pK was the negative log base 10 of K, pH is the negative log base 10 of H+, the negative log base 10 of 10 to the minus 7 is 7, and so we've just derived that the pH of pure water is 7. 7 is the mid value on the pH scale, which is sometimes plotted from 0 to 14. And here's the pure water value. Things that are acidic will have lower pH. Things that are basic will have higher pH. Okay, so we've just solved a very simple equilibrium problem and learned something. Let's look at a more complicated problem. Suppose I take a liter of water, pure water, and I'm going to add to it, I'm going to take that case of adding a liquid chemical, something off the shelf, to the pure water. And I'm going to add, and you'll see why I'm taking such a funny number in a minute, 0.63 grams of pure nitric acid, HNO3. Why did I take 0.63? Let's look at the molecular weight of HNO3. It's got a 1 for the H, it's got a 14 for the N, and it's got 3 times 16, or 48, for the oxygen. And by coincidence, that adds up to 63. So when I pick 0.63 grams, I'm picking 0.01 moles. And I'm adding it to a liter of water. So this is how much stuff I'm adding initially. And let's see what happens. Okay. We know from a reaction I wrote right here. Oh, I didn't write it. Let me write it here. What's going to happen is that HNO3 in water is going to dissociate to H plus plus NO3 minus. And it will go backwards. And when the forward and backward rate are in equilibrium, are equal, we've got chemical equilibrium. And if I put this into this, equilibrium would establish within a fraction of a second. Very quick. What would the equilibrium look like? What will the pH of the water be when I've done this? Alrighty, we can work that out. We need to know the dissociation, the equilibrium constant for nitric acid. Now we can't set the denominator equal to 1 because that's not water, it's HNO3. And we have to go back and look in the appendix to Cal or in the physics and chemistry handbook to see what this is. And it turns out it's a pK of minus 1. So it's equal to 10 to the minus 1, which is a K of 10. Not exactly 1, but it's actually very, very close to 1. For our purposes, we'll just call it 1, make life simple. So we have a constraining piece of information about what happens when I put the nitric acid in the water. I have an equation. Now, what are the unknowns and what are the equations we've got? We have, as an unknown, H plus, and there'll be OH minus, and there'll be NO3 minus, and there'll be some HNO3 that won't dissociate. Those are the four things that can exist in my liter of water after I've put the nitric acid in. And we want to know how much of each of these there'll be. Okay. What about these two? We're still going to have water dissociating into H plus and OH minus. So I'm going to write it down and then emphasize an important point. I'm writing down exactly the same equation I wrote down over here. Now, you may wonder, over here, we were dealing with pure water, and water dissociates, and that's the pK, 14. Now we've got two sources of H plus. H plus from the dissociation of water and H plus from the dissociation of nitric acid. Still, I can write this equation. Each equilibrium equation holds independently of all the other equilibrium equations and reactions going on in the water. In equilibrium, every chemical reaction is subject to the constraints of its equilibrium equation given by its pK. So you can write the equilibrium equations for each sub-process going on in this more complicated tub of water independently of all the others. And that's valid. It only starts to go wrong when concentrations get huge. You know, when you've got a sludge of nitric acid in your water and not a small amount. We're adding a relatively small amount when we deal with acid rain, when we look at the carbon entering water from CO2 in the atmosphere. We're always dealing with smallish concentrations, like on the order of parts per thousand or parts per million or parts per billion. So for all practical purposes, we will always, in anything we deal with in this course, take these reactions to be independently in equilibrium. So we have these four equations, and we had one equation, and now we have another equation. Is there any more? Two equations won't determine four unknowns, but surely if I do this experiment, some answer will occur, and I ought to be able to calculate it. So what am I missing? What information haven't I used yet? When? Well, we want to find the pH. When we know this, we'll know the pH. But we won't know that until we solve for the H+. Yeah. I'm sorry, say it again, louder. Yeah, that's one piece. Exactly. And that's will give me a third equation. Namely, I can write it like this. Let's write that one here, actually. HNO3 plus NO3 minus equals 0.01. That's what you said correctly. And why is it true? Why would I write this? Initially, I had 0.01 mole per liter of HNO3. And so I had 0.01 mole per liter of N. Now, the N can only be in two places. It can be in the HNO3, or it can be in the NO3 minus. And the sum of those has to add up to the total number of moles per liter of N. And so I couldn't say that for H, because H comes and goes out of the H2O, and we're not keeping track of the H2O. It's sort of this, you know, big invisible elephant in the background. But the N we can keep track of. And the N is conserved. So the N that was initially all in this form at 0.01 mole per liter is now in either of those forms. And so the sum must be 0.01 mole per liter. All right. We're making progress. Three equations. But there's four unknowns. What am I ignoring? Charge balance. Thank you. I'm sorry, what? Good. The plus charge can only exist as H+. There's no other positively charged thing in the problem. But there's two types of negative charge in the problem, OH minus and NO3 minus. And the sum of the negative charge in moles or in Avogadro's numbers as a unit must equal the sum of the positive charges. And so I've got my fourth equation, and now we have to figure out how to solve them. And let me show you, go through that quickly, and we'll do a little trick. Those are our equations. It usually helps to start out with the charge balance equation. In almost all problems where we want to find the, for example, the pH of the ocean, it's a calculation that you'll do for homework. What's the pH of the ocean if it's in equilibrium with atmospheric CO2? It won't be 7, because the bicarbonate that enters into seawater when CO2 dissolves in the water makes the water basic. And so the pH will be above 7. And when you want to solve for it, or in a simpler problem, keep the H plus equals the negative stuff. And now we're going to substitute out the negative stuff and get an equation just for H plus. Okay, how do we do that? Well, first of all, for the OH minus, I can write 10 to the minus 14 over H plus. That's straightforward. The nitrate takes a little bit more work. I can use this equation in combination with the one at the top to write NO3 minus equals 0.01 divided by H plus over 10 plus 1. I'll let you do the algebra. I want you to show on your own that this equation and this equation allow me to eliminate HNO3, because I can write HNO3 is 0.01 minus NO3 minus. substitute that in for this, and get an equation that relates NO3 just to H+. And that's what it looks like. And so this is 0.01 over H+ over 10 plus 1. Now I have an equation I can solve for H+. But it's kind of an ugly equation, because it turns out it's a cubic equation. If I get rid of this stuff in the denominator by multiplying both sides by this times this, I'll end up with an H plus cubed on the left side. And cubic equations are ugly. So we could solve it. You could, you can solve cubic equations. You can certainly do it numerically. But let's be lazy. I want to show you a very useful pair of shortcuts which allow us to quickly get an answer, a good answer. Let's, first of all, make the assumption that this term is small. And the reason we'd be tempted to do that is because we're adding an acid to water. And if I'm adding an acid, then this should be, I should end up with a pH less than 7. And so this term should probably be small. Now, it may not be, but I'm going to assume it is, and then later we'll get an answer and go back and verify that that was indeed small. Okay, now I can multiply this by this, and I get H plus squared over 10 plus H plus equals 0.01. I've just multiplied this over there and gotten a quadratic equation. Now, I could solve the quadratic equation. I assume you all know how to solve a quadratic equation on a piece of paper and pencil. But let's be even lazier. Let's not do that. Let's make a guess that this term is small compared to that. Okay? I'm going to put a question mark here, because these may not be good guesses, and we have to independently verify that they were good. Now we all know how to solve that equation, H plus equals 0.01. Now let's go back and ask, was our guess warranted? If H plus is 0.01, this term would be 10 to the minus 5. And this term would be 10 to the minus 2. And this is way, way, way smaller than that, by a factor of 1,000. So it was valid to neglect that. This is a funny thing, and it takes a little getting used to, but it's defensible. In the kind of equations that show up in any chemical equilibrium problem you'll ever see, if you ignore certain terms, simplify the equation, solve that simplified equation, get an answer, and then go back and verify that if that answer were right, the terms you ignored could indeed be ignored, then you were justified ignoring them. So you're self-consistently verifying your approximation by using the answer you get when you made the approximation. Math is wonderful in that, except in the case of very sick or pathological equations, this process works. Now, we can also go back and ask, were we justified ignoring that? And I'll let you show that if you substitute in this value, this term is way bigger than this term. Now, just to further persuade you that this is okay, if you solve this quadratic exactly, instead of H plus equals 0.01, we would have gotten, and I just did this numerically, 999 something, something, something. In other words, instead of 0.01, this would have been 0.00999, which is almost 0.01. They differ by about a part in 1,000. So we're getting an answer that's accurate to a part per 1,000 when we made that assumption, that we could neglect this and solve this. So we got the answer, H plus is 0.01. What's the pH now of this system? The pH is negative log base 10 of the H plus, and that's a negative log base 10 of 0.01, and that's equal to 2. So 0.01 is 10 to the minus 2, and the negative log base 10 of 10 to the minus 2 is plus 2. So we ended up with an answer that you might think, gee, we could have just written it down at the beginning. We ended up with H plus at 0.01, and not coincidentally, we added 0.01 moles per liter of nitric acid. Why did that work? Okay, if you go back through the guts of this calculation, you will see that the reason it worked is that 0.0... Let me write this here. The reason it worked is that the concentration we added, 0.01, was less than 10 to the minus pK, for the substance that we added, the nitric acid. This is equal to 10, and 0.01 is indeed a lot less than 10. If you added not 0.01 moles per liter, but 10 moles per liter of nitric acid, then you would have started to see something very different happen. You would have started to see that you couldn't make these simplifying approximations. The substance wouldn't entirely dissociate into H+. In our case, we added a sufficiently dilute amount of nitric acid that all of it dissociates. So all the HNO3 became this, and the amount of HNO3 left at the end was very, very small. You can calculate how much HNO3 there is in the system, and it's negligible. It essentially all dissociated. It only dissociated because we added a concentration that was less than the 10 to the minus pK of the substance. If I had given you a different chemical and I had added 0.01 moles per liter, but the pK were 3, then this would be 10 to the minus 3 or 0.001. This would not be less than this, and it would not have all dissociated. Only a small portion will. So the the smaller the pK value, the closer to zero, or better yet, the more negative it is, the stronger the acid, because it means more of the stuff dissociates when it enters into water. And in fact, if you drew a graph of concentration of stuff added, of acid added, into pure water, and here is 10 to the minus pK, and we're adding more and more, and we want to see how much H plus comes out, it's proportional. As you add more acid, it all dissociates, and you get more acid out. The amount of H plus will equal the amount you add until you approach the 10 to the minus pK concentration, and then it actually starts to go like the square root of the concentration. It takes a little more work to show that, the square root of the amount you add. But up until you get near 10 to the minus pK, you get complete dissociation. So we refer to weak acids as acids with large pK values, so they don't lead to complete dissociation, and we refer to strong acids as acids with either smaller negative pK values, like minus 1 for nitric acid. Very strong. Takes a lot of, you have to add a lot of acid before you approach it and start to quench the dissociation process. So it up to this level, the pH of the water will be the negative log base 10 of what you added. Beyond that, it starts to get more complicated. I'm going to stop there. Next time, we're going to work out the carbonate system, and we'll see some very interesting things when we look at that.